last lecture, we'll go back to spins after we learned about bosons and learned about superfluidity and superconductivity. We'll go back to see why still what we learned about spins would be interesting and relevant for these other systems. So how do you go from spins to bosons? Well, there's a transformation you did in the tutorial. I'll repeat it rapidly. It's called the Holstein-Primakov transformation. It's a representation, one of the many representations of spins. You could use Holstein-Primakov bosons. You could use Dyson-Malev representation. There's Schwinger bosons. There's fermionic representations. But what we're interested here is the Holstein-Primakov. The Holstein-Primakov says you take SZ and you write it as a number operator of bosons minus S. You take S plus and you write it in kind of a complicated form, which is B dagger. That's one way of doing it. You can do it 2S minus N. S minus is the complex conjugate, so it's 2S minus 1 square root B. So this looks complicated, but actually that's what we need when we use bosons to represent spins, because remember that if we apply S plus to a state that is maximally occupied, which is N is equal to 2S, then this should vanish because S plus times the maximal state should vanish. So this makes sure that the raising operator doesn't exceed the spectrum of spin, which is limited from minus S to plus S. So when you apply S plus to this state, this will make sure it vanishes. Similarly, if you apply S minus to the bottom state, again, it will vanish because of this 2S minus N. So that's the purpose of this factor. This factor for spin a half makes these bosons hardcore bosons, because when spin a half, you have just two states, plus minus a half. So N runs between 0 and 1. 0 is minus a half, 1 is plus a half. So again, if you apply S plus to the top state, it vanishes. To the bottom state, it vanishes with S minus. And that's the representation. Well, in order to make sure that this is really a spin representation, one has to calculate the commutation relations, SZ S plus. We know that this should be plus S plus according to the angular momentum algebra. And when we use these operators, it's easy to see that. I'll just give you an example how you do it. You take N, you commute it with B plus. Now, 2S minus N commutes with N, so it's just B plus. And then the square root of 2S minus N. N and B plus, according to commutation relations of bosons, is just B plus. So this is B plus 2S minus N, which is indeed S plus. And similarly, you do with S minus. And the last thing you have to check is that when you take S squared, which is just SZ squared plus a half S plus S minus plus S minus S plus, when you plug in all these operators and you move them around a little bit, you get that this is simply S squared plus S, which is precisely what the S squared eigenvalues are supposed to be in a representation S. Yes? Okay, so hardcore bosons are essentially defined as spin a half Holstein-Primakov bosons. So I'll define it now. Equal to Holstein-Primakov representation of S equal a half. So why is that? Because we have two states, N equals 0, N equal 1. Hardcore means that the state N equal 2 costs you infinite energy. So the whole Hilbert space is just two states. Two states you could write in terms of spin up, spin down. That's the spin representation of two states. And it's useful to use spin representation and boson representation interchangeably because they both commute at different sites. They're not like fermions, which anti-commute. When people use fermions to represent spins, they have to worry about this fictitious anti-commutation that you get on different sites, and you have to fix it with string operators. And that's only doable in one dimension. So here we don't have these problems of different sites. We're just discovering a single site here. But bosons, as you know, commute with any other boson at any other site and so on. So that's the way we go from spins to bosons. So now, if we look at the Hamiltonian that we got last time for superconductors and charged density waves, it was the pseudo-spin Hamiltonian H minus X minus XZ pseudo-spin. And we can write it as a sum of a bonds. There was a J. Let's call it JXY. And there was a S plus, S minus, S plus divided by 2. IJ, that was the XY term. It was ferromagnetic. And then there was a JZ, SZ, SZ, which was antiferromagnetic. And there was a chemical potential, mu SZI, essentially was it like a magnetic field coupled to SZI. If I write this in terms of Holstein-Primakov bosons, okay, I just use this representation, the minute, I get a JXY. Here I'll have, you see, B dagger 2S minus NI. And then it'll be a 2s minus nj, bj, plus, this guy's the Hermitian conjugate. I'll write it explicitly. So you get 2s minus ni. Just write plus Hermitian conjugate. This term is JZ N minus S, NI minus S, NJ minus S. This guy is mu I, and here I'll have NI. Now, plus constant, which I'm not interested in. So if you look at this Hamiltonian, it looks like a mess, looks like density operators, creation operators. Doesn't look like anything simple, but I can now start thinking about this Hamiltonian. When does it become simple? It becomes simple when the density is actually very small. Just a second, I'll finish this and I'll answer questions. So when the density is small, higher powers of density, like these terms, Ni and J, will be small. Higher powers here of density will be small. I can expand this square root. Expanding the square root, actually, let me now limit ourselves to hardcore bosons, which is spin a half, as I said. So I'm just going to replace all these 2s by 1. That's for spin a half, right? Well, this is going to be a half and a half. Okay. This square root is 1 minus a half ni plus an 8 ni squared. This is 1 minus a half ni nj plus an 8 nj squared. And I can now see that there is a term here, a very important term, that is bi dagger bj and a Hermitian conjugate, which multiplies the 1. And I want to isolate this one, so I have minus sum over j, ij, jx divided by 2, and then I'm going to have bi dagger bj plus bj dagger bi. That's a single particle Hamiltonian here of a hopping of a boson from site I to J with a magnitude of the hopping given by Jxy divided by 2. And I'll get a chemical potential minus mu, and then I'll get also terms from here, sum over ijjz times a half, and that will be multiplied by ni. So it's again a single particle term with a chemical potential that is renormalized by this Ising terms. I think it's a minus here. Minus here. Well, actually, no, the minus, it's plus. Okay. And constants, and then I'll have terms which are higher order in density. So, for instance, the first term higher order in density is ni and j times sz. So I'll call this H interaction. And H interaction will have terms like ij, jz, ni, and j plus ij, jx. And now I have to just start with bi, bj, bi dagger, bj. And in the middle, I'll have ni. And here I'll have a plus nj plus order n. If this is of order n squared, this higher order terms will be n cubed and n fourth. Okay, questions? The hardcore bosons have no spin on them. They're just particles that can be either occupied or unoccupied, okay? I'm using them to represent the pseudo-spin that I got last two lectures. Remember, from the Hubbard model, I got a pseudo-spin. Now I just want to write it in terms of operators that I would find useful, which are bosonic operators, Holstein-Primakov. And now I plug it into the Hamiltonian, and I get this kind of a bosonic Hamiltonian that has a single particle term and interaction term. So the bosons that I'm left with in the end are hardcore in the sense that you cannot have two of them at the same site, but you can have 0 or 1. When I write this Hamiltonian and I expand it in terms of densities, what I'm really doing is I'm having all these sites, okay? This is I equal 1, this is I equal 2, yeah, let's say in one dimension. I have the two occupation numbers, n equals 0 and I equal 1. And I'm thinking of a system where most of the time the sites are empty. But occasionally, there'll be some boson somewhere. So the average density I want to look at for this representation is a low density representation with a number of occupied sites are small, but these are bosons. They commute with each other, and they hop around with magnitude jxy. And I'll be able to ignore the interactions and the hardcore constraint and all the complication of being hardcore bosons at low densities, because it's very rare the two bosons will actually meet and want to sit on the same site. So this is an approximation scheme that works at low densities that turns the problem of spins to hardcore bosons into essentially bosons which are weakly interacting, or bosons that have no interaction at the zeroth order and you have some perturbation which is a weak interaction. So it's a density expansion, a low density expansion. So if I want to think of, again, where did I come from? I came from the fermionic problem of attractive interaction. I got the negative U-Hubbard model. I turned it to a positive U. I turned it to pseudospins. And now I look at a system where I'm putting a strong magnetic field such that my spin, my density is very far from 1. It becomes close to 0. Okay? So it's really a system where mu is large in order for me to, in terms of spins, think about a system that is mostly polarized down, right? These are all empty sites. They're polarized down. And occasionally I'll have a spin up. That's called a very low negative magnetization, which is the limit of low density. And that's the limit when this model becomes free bosons, and free bosons are easy to handle. Because essentially we'll now go to discuss weakly interacting bosons and how we treat them and how we go to the continuum limit. And one thing that will happen is the effects of the lattice will become less important. But you can see that already, because once the density of bosons becomes low, there's a length scale, which is the distance between bosons. And that length scale, if it's much larger than the lattice constant, then the lattice constant goes away and we can forget the lattice. Yes, question. I'm throwing away all the complicated terms, the powers of n.
That's what you mean by the condition of the hardcore boson.
The hardcore boson condition is encoded in these square roots. Once I expand them, I kind of lose that condition. So you can say, am I doing something terrible to the model? And the answer is, at low densities, you're expanding, because it's an asymptotic expansion. But you can argue that the effects of the hardcore constraints are negligible, and physically you expect them to be negligible when the bosons become distant from each other. So in fact, every time people discuss real bosons, they want to discuss these real bosons in terms of free bosons, in other words, neglect their interaction, they're throwing away hardcore constraints. For instance, in helium, to put two helium atoms on top of each other costs, even not close to each other, even close within their core radius, costs you very many electron volts. However, a theory of helium-4 many times uses weakly interacting bosons. Question is it justified? Well, for helium, it's not so justified, because even in the superfluid, the core interaction is important. But for, let's say, the cold atoms cases, the core interaction, which is very, very large, is unimportant because the density is low. And when the density is low, on the average, even though to put a second boson on exactly this site costs you infinite energy, the other boson rarely visits this site because the density is low. And that gives you a way of ignoring the hardcore constraint. What we're going to do now is actually discuss the theory of weakly interacting bosons. So we won't have the hardcore constraint, and we won't have the lattice. We'll go away from the lattice, and we'll discuss essentially superfluidity in the continuum. And it is justified, even when you have a lattice, as I say, at strong doping away from half-filling or low density of bosons. Of course, in interesting situations, that's not the case, and one has to go back to the pseudo-spin model and see what is the difference between the pseudo-spin model and the approximations we're going to make now, which is weakly interacting bosons. Okay, so now we want to go to second quantization of bosons, and which I'm sure you know from quantum mechanics and all your preparatory courses. But so that's why I'm going to go fast on this business, and a lot of it looks very similar to the second quantization of fermions we did already. Very similar results, but of course with some important differences. Okay, and yeah. So
originally the Ni are the number of electrons,
right? And then after the transformation, you you're absolutely right, except for a factor of 2. An occupied site of a boson is one boson, but if you went back to the Ni of the fermions, it'll be 2 fermions. It'll be spin up, spin down. So in terms of densities, there's a close relation. But you're counting Cooper pairs now. You're not counting electrons anymore. There's no such thing in this effective Hamiltonian of a free electron. A single spin doesn't exist in our Hilbert space anymore. We threw it away when we got to this Hamiltonian. And we don't need to bring it back.
I'm not talking about the I'm saying like the
The Hultzfeld-Primakov transformation is general for any size spin, whether it's made out of fermions or made out of any other object you want. It's something to do with angular momentum. So for spin a half, okay, that's the transformation. It's not related necessarily to the original fermions. It's just a way of representing 2s plus 1 states in terms of a creation annihilation, bosonic creation annihilation operator, that's all. Okay? So, second quantization of bosons. Crash review. So, you have a Hilbert space of single particles. Single particle, of course, doesn't care if it's a boson, fermion, or anything. It's just one particle. So you have a single particle, phi I, such that phi I, phi j is orthogonal. And I'm using a discrete basis again. I runs from 1 to some m. And I define phi I as a creation operator I, a bosonic creation operator I on the vacuum. And Ni is A dagger IAI, and Ni AI dagger or non-dagger commutation relation is plus minus AI dagger or non-dagger. Oh, non-dagger, I guess, is not, put zero here. So this is the commutation relation of harmonic oscillator creation annihilation operators. And of course, you can define a Fock space. A Fock space for bosons is essentially all the lists n1 to nm, where n1 and n to nm can run over all values, integer values larger or equal to zero. So the space, the grand canonical ensemble, the unit in the grand canonical ensemble Hilbert space is sum over n1, n2, and m runs from 0 to infinity, n1 to nm, n1 to nm. It's a complete covering of Hilbert space, but now instead of n runs between 0 and 1, it runs to infinity. So I'm using now not hardcore bosons, but free bosons. They can occupy any number and any site. And this is my grand canonical Hilbert space. And I can write down the Fock space, the Fock state n I as a product over I, a I dagger to the power n I divided by square root of n I factorial times the vacuum I. So with fermions, of course, you didn't need this factorial because a I could only be 0, 1, n I could only be 0, 1, but here you need the factorial to have the right normalization. And that is the definition of my Fock states. And this is the resolution identity with Fock states. OK, so second quantization of bosons is quite straightforward. And now I want to describe field operators. Field operators are defined from this discrete set because I want to avoid mathematical difficulties. And one of the biggest difficulties in mathematical physics is dealing with continuous second quantized operators, because all this algebra is very simple when the index I is discrete. When it's continuous, we have problems. So in order to avoid those, I'm defining my field operator psi of x as simply psi of x is simply going to be 1 over 2 pi to the power d times the volume square root. That's a normalization. Sum over all the q's that, okay, sorry. Sorry, I skipped the state. Okay, just a second. Before I define the field operator, I define my plane wave basis. Plane wave basis, discrete still. Yes, it's for the one particle. So instead of using index I, I want to use index Q, but it's still going to be discrete. A of Q. So how is it going to be defined? It's going to be defined by A dagger Q of 0 is phi Q of X, where phi Q of X is one over two pi to the dv square root e to the I q dot x. So this is the wave function. It's plane wave functions normalized on a box of size v in dimension d. So it's two pi to the power dv half. This object here defines the wave function in real space x given by momentum Q. Q now is a wave vector that could go between 0 and infinity on periodic boundary conditions. What does it mean? Because this will not be, for instance, a solution of the Laplacian unless I put periodic boundary conditions. But if I use periodic boundary conditions, then this becomes a solution of phi of Q of X, solution of free particle Hamiltonian. And Q X runs between 2 pi, runs between 0 plus minus 2 pi over LX up to essentially infinity in a discrete set. Because the volume is finite, my set is discrete. That's the most important point. So QY, same thing, 0, 2 pi divided by LY up to infinity. So these values are all discrete. And when I want to do a sum, I'm essentially summing over this list. So I want to define my field operator now. My field operator is going to define in terms of these A of Q. So psi of X is defined as 1 over 2 pi to the dv to the half, sum over all allowed Qs. Now this is a sum over three-dimensional vectors, e to the I q dot x, A of Q. So everything's well defined. I know the commutation relation of A of Q because that's a discrete set. It covers the whole Hilbert space of this finite volume. A of Q prime dagger is equal to delta Kronecker of Q and Q prime. So so that's good enough. And now I want the inverse transformation. A of Q is 1 over the same kind of factor, 2 pi to the dv to the half. Now it's an integral dx over all space up to v to the power d, e to the minus I q x times psi of x. Okay, now the question is, what is the commutation between different fields? So the commutation between different fields, psi of x prime, dagger. If it's not dagger, of course it commutes because it's made out of A's and the psi dagger is made out of A daggers. So dagger commutes with dagger, A's, non-dagger commutes with non-dagger. So the only interesting place is psi with psi dagger, a different position x and x prime. And by just plugging it in, you get, if you plug in for psi this expression, you get 1 over 2 pi to the d times the volume from twice this factor, sum over q, sum over q prime, and then there'll be e to the I qx, e to the I q prime x prime, and the commutation aqa q prime, which is delta q q prime. That eliminates this sum. And I'm ending up with 1 over 2 pi to the d times v, sum over q, and then I have e to the I q dot x minus x prime. Okay, so here we notice that when you take the volume to be large, you actually can write this sum in terms of an integral dq, because if you define dqx as one over the distance lx, so dq d is 1 over volume, essentially what you get here is an integral d dq divided by 2 pi to the d, e to the I q dot x minus x prime. And now this integral is, when it's taken from on all space of dq, becomes just delta function to the power d, x minus x prime. So I get a Dirac delta, not a Kronecker delta, in real space. So these operators, notice they have different dimensions than the second quantized operator in discrete space. While the second operators in discrete space have no dimension, they have no dimensional value, these guys, because of this square root of v, they have dimension of L to the d over minus d over 2. So field operators have dimension of 1 over distance to the d over 2, and field operators commute to give you Dirac delta functions, while discrete operators give you Kronecker delta. Now these will turn out to be very useful to understand long wavelength and low energy phenomena. Remember all this business of renormalization we discussed before. So when one wants to have a theory of low energy, long wavelength, it's useful to use field operators, because as you can see, I can define them now to be actually constructed from the low part of Q spectrum. And this is what's called a regularized field operator. So up to this point, I didn't do any regularization. I summed over all Q. Q went actually to infinity, right? All the Qs went up to infinity here. But in real practice, I'm not interested in having all the momentum participate in this party. I just want the low energy part. I want the low frequency part in the Hamiltonian, in the correlation functions, in the observables. And therefore, it's useful for me to also define field operators that are constructed from the low momenta, the low wave vector part of the Fourier transform. So I'll extend the definition of Fourier transform to regularized Fourier transform. And that's extremely useful notion. This is a notion that particle physicists have used for ages, statistical mechanics and condensed matter. Because once you define a transform that only concentrates on the long wavelengths, you'll be able to simplify Hamiltonian immensely, simplify the calculations immensely. So I want to define this regularized field, which is a very simple extension of what I defined here. Is there questions? You have a question? Yeah? Just a second. A sub q is a creation operator of a mode called q. Exactly like a sub I is a mode called I. Q is a label, it's a discrete label, that's important. It's not a continuous label like x, it's discrete. And even though I can cavalierly call, okay, now I do. I don't want this. Okay. So about all this mess. Okay, so. Yes. Oh, it ruined my book. Okay. Yes. What are you asking? Yes. Exactly what I'm going to do now. It's called regularized field operator. Okay. So a regularized field operator is defining what I said that before, psi twiddle of x is 1 over 2 pi to the d volume square root sum over all momenta q less than lambda, e to the I q x a q. So I'm picking out of this sum here, not all the momenta, but just momenta less than lambda. And I'm getting a field operator constructed of low wavelength, okay? So when I do this, I'm not doing a full Fourier transform. I'm doing a Fourier transform of part of the A of Q. But question is, what do I get for the commutation of psi and psi dagger? So psi x, psi dagger x prime, if I evaluate this, let's do it in one dimension to make it simple. This is going to be 1 over 2 pi L from the 2. And then I have here, I dq, there was 1, and it runs between 0 and lambda. Actually, it runs between minus lambda and lambda, sorry. Minus lambda and lambda, e to the I q x minus x prime. And that is not a delta function because it's going between minus lambda and lambda. That function, actually, sorry, there's no L here. L went into the definition of the measure here. So what I get here is sine lambda x minus x prime divided by x pi. There's a 2 that cancels this 2, and there's a pi x minus x prime. This is a sinc function that looks like this. It's actually quite slowly decaying in magnitude, like 1 over x, but it oscillates wildly. And at 0, its value here is going to be lambda divided by pi. And the width of the central peak is something of the order pi divided by lambda. So you can see the area of the central peak is essentially 1. It's normalized to 1. All the rest oscillates. When such a function, I take lambda to infinity, I get a representation of a delta function. But if I don't take lambda to infinity, I get a representation of a delta function. I can call this delta twiddle lambda of x minus x prime. And what it does, it samples functions exactly like a delta function, as long as my functions that are sampled have a characteristic length which is much larger than 1 over lambda. So any function like that, if this is some kind of an f of x, has a characteristic length scale. Let's call it psi. So if psi is much, much larger than lambda to the minus 1, or if you want, the Fourier components of f are typically momenta which are smaller. It's weighted at q much smaller than lambda, than the wave vector that defines this cutoff, then it behaves exactly like a delta function, because integral of f of x delta twiddle of x minus x prime will just give me f of x prime, which is the property of a delta function. So this holds dx. This holds exactly like it does in a delta function, as long as f varies slowly. So I don't need all the high Fourier components in my Fourier transform if I want to use sampling functions which are a bit smeared. And this is the whole philosophy behind creating fields. And in quantum field theory, when you learn about fields, you're exactly doing these kind of things. And when people say we have an ultraviolet cutoff, this is what they mean. They mean we're not really talking about Dirac delta functions. We're not really talking about infinitesimal objects. Every particle has a radius. Every particle has some size. Effectively, once you put in all the quantum corrections. And when you use the field, you're actually using it in the context that all the correlations that you're interested in and all the functions you're sampling are just smoother compared to the cutoff size lambda. And from here on, I'm going to essentially use this field with some implicit cutoff. And you have to remember the cutoff has to be coming from physical considerations, right? I can't just invent it. I need to justify it by physical considerations. So the first operator that one can define when you have a field is a local density. So local density, now it's going to be an operator that is not so sensitive to exactly tell you what the local density is. It's psi, let's call it rho tilde. It will obey rho tilde of x, psi dagger tilde of x prime is plus this delta tilde of x minus x prime, psi dagger of x. I put back higher dimensions. So you see that when you do these calculations, you get exactly the same as you get in the non-regularized, but you get the same kind of expressions. But you have to remember that your delta function is not precisely a delta function. Your fields are smeared, and your density also doesn't have the resolution better than inverse lambda. But other than that, I can just keep lambda as a parameter and forget about it, and forget about the tildes, and don't worry about this regularization procedure until I need to use it for, you know, getting real numbers out of the system or something. Yeah. Yeah. So from this point on, I'm just going to throw away the tildes and use them in my Hamiltonians freely without the tildes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And that's what's always done. Okay, so in every book in field theory that you read, commutation relations, it's always there. Very few people, you know, take pain to explain what's going on. But now that we have it, we want to write, for instance, a Hamiltonian for bosons. So free particles, right? We know that H, free, is given by sum over Q, H bar Q squared divided by 2m, A of Q. That's just counting how many modes I have at momentum Q, and giving each mode H bar Q divided by 2m energy. That's going to give me the free particle Hamiltonian. And I can now write this in terms of the fields psi. Even when I cut this less than lambda, and it's just going to be integral dx d psi dagger x. And q becomes the Laplacian. A Q squared becomes a Laplacian. So I have here minus H bar, because it's minus the Laplacian, because Fourier transform gives me a gradient goes to IQ, and oh, minus IQ, so I get here I squared, so I get a minus H squared a Laplacian divided by 2m psi of x. So this is now an operator taking derivatives of this field and giving me the kinetic energy. That's the kinetic energy. And I wrote it now in terms of field operator in real space. Okay? Just before I go on, I can go back to this Hamiltonian and show you that this Hamiltonian actually will give you exactly the same kinetic energy if you look at low momentum. Why? Because this Hamiltonian, it's a lattice Hamiltonian. I can solve it because it's bilinear. I can diagonalize the tight binding model. I get this function gamma k. You all remember it now quite well. So if I want to see how I get this kind of a Hamiltonian from a lattice, so I'll do minus j, and then I have sum over ij ai dagger aj plus Hermitian conjugate, I'll Fourier transform. It'll be minus j z minus sum over nearest neighbors e to the iq times nearest neighbor vector. That's essentially what happens when I Fourier transform, and then a of q. So now the question is, what is this function? Well, this function I expand to small q. There's z nearest neighbors, so the 1 cancels this z, and I get the rest is a half, and then sum over eta q dot eta squared, and there's multiplied by minus j. But now it's multiplied by minus, and this is, oh, sorry, this was plus, so. Yeah, so it's positive. This is nothing but, in a sense, j over 2 q. Now let's say that let's say it's a cubic lattice, make life simple. All these etas are size a, so it's q squared times a squared. A of q. That's my Hamiltonian when q is much less than pi over a, where a is the lattice constant, because I'm expanding this to small q times a. So q times a has to be much smaller than pi. So when q is much smaller than pi over a, I can say the Hamiltonian in the low q part, let's call it lambda, is precisely a quadratic Hamiltonian that looks like free particle Hamiltonian. All I have to do is identify the mass. So this becomes essentially h bar squared q squared divided by 2m star, and sooner we'll see what m star is, times a of dagger q, sum over q. So all I need to identify is that, it's not a good place to write it, I write it here, that h bar squared divided by m a squared is j. M star. This is a definition of my effective mass. So the bosons hopping on the lattice actually at low density look like free bosons with an effective mass that depends on the hopping jxy. That's what jxy. Okay? So there is a notion of a mass. It's essentially related to the lattice constant and the size of the couplings between the lattice. It doesn't necessarily have to do with the original electron mass or anything like that. It's something to do with T and U and all these parameters of the Hubbard model if you start from electrons. But there is a mass here, and we can define it this way. And now, this Hamiltonian could be written exactly in terms of this field theory, except put here M star. Yes?
When you put this Hamiltonian
B sub I? Ah, yes. Okay, so I have here a free Hamiltonian. Okay, but there's more terms, there's interaction terms. The bosons, now I'm talking about generally bosons in continuum space, because now this is a continuum theory, will also interact, and I want to see how to write interactions in terms of second quantized fields and how to simplify the interaction. Yes. It's beyond my depth. I'm sure there's some fancy theorems in information theory for this. What? This is what? No, this is a physical procedure. It's not formal. I'm trying to get rid of high wave vectors to approximate a theory, a long wavelength theory, okay? So how do I do it? I need to define my fields. For instance, in this particular example, that's exactly where I did this example. This is not the correct Hamiltonian. This is the correct Hamiltonian on a small q. So it wouldn't make any sense to define my field operators as the full Fourier transform of A of Q, when in fact I want to leave only the second order gradient term. Okay? So how do I do it? Why am I allowed to write only second power of gradient when in fact this function here is very nonlinear in terms of Q? I should add the fourth gradient, the sixth gradient, and I'm throwing them away. Why? Because I'm saying I'm only taking in the Fourier transform and in the definition of this size, and therefore in the definition of the Hamiltonian, the Fourier transform of the low part of the spectrum. Okay? So I'm constructing an effective Hamiltonian this way. This is the field theoretic way of constructing an effective Hamiltonian, to put a cutoff on the Fourier components and to smear the delta function. Okay, that's the procedure. There's nothing formal about it because I'm generating an approximation. Okay, so I'm actually not doing anything rigorous here in the sense of making an exact mapping. I'm generating constantly an approximation. Now, in order to make sense with an approximation, they have to come back to the approximation later and say, is it consistent with the solution I'm going to get? The same way as spin wave theory, it was an approximation for long wavelengths, and it was an approximation that assumed long range order, and eventually you find there's no long range order, so you have to throw away spin wave theory. So there's always a way of checking your methodology later, but it's not, as I say, it's not a deductible procedure here, that one follows from the other exactly. Yeah. Yes. The interaction part will contribute to the potential. The non-interacting part, the quadratic part, bilinear part is non-interacting. That will give you the kinetic term.
The first term is the
kinetic. Well, okay, sorry. This is the kinetic. This is the chemical potential. I didn't put the chemical potential in here. JC?
J
You talk about this guy?
Yeah.
Okay, this is completely unimportant. It just adds to the chemical potential. Chemical potential is a parameter that you can choose at will. So you just call this mu prime and you just absorb it in the chemical potential. Okay? Okay, so now we want to write the interaction term. And then we'll have the full interacting boson Hamiltonian written in terms of a field theory. So how do I do that? Very simple. I come from classical mechanics. I know how to write interactions between particles using the expressions that we have from non-relativistic mechanics or electrostatics or van der Waals or whatever interactions we have. Okay. So how does the interaction look like in single particle or single first quantization? V is half sum over I different than j, V of xi minus xj. Okay, now I can always write this as half integral dx prime, and then I write V of x minus x prime, and I put here the sum. I, j, different than j, delta of x minus xi, Dirac delta of x prime minus xj. I haven't done anything because I introduced delta functions that integrate to 1. But there's an I different than j. I want to get rid of that. So I'll put I and j are summed over everything. And I'll take here delta of x minus xi delta of x minus x prime minus xj, x prime minus xi. So the I equal to j I just subtract from this guy. Now, this delta function, sum over I and j, are essentially densities. So exactly like we do in classical mechanics, we can write this as a half d dx, d dx prime, v of x minus x prime, rho of x prime. These are now density operators. It's true that here they're written as a sum of delta functions, but you can easily imagine that there will be smooth delta functions minus delta of x minus x prime, rho of x. So this is still written exactly like you would expect in classical mechanics, where I define rho of x is sum over I delta of x minus xi. That's in first quantization. Now to move to second quantization, it's very easy. No, I don't want that. Okay. No. Okay, to move to second quantization, all I need to do is replace these guys by psi dagger x, psi of x, psi dagger x prime, psi of x prime. That's really just density, right? Written in terms of second quantized operators. When I apply this to a Fock state, I'll get a contribution if the Fock state is occupied, and no contribution if it's not occupied. That's what a density operator does. So I have this at x prime, minus delta of x minus x prime, psi dagger of x, psi of x. This is going from first quantization to second quantization. Nothing more than just substituting into the density description. Okay, now here, notice that I can change the order here, and I'll get psi dagger of x prime plus and the commutator is the delta function of x minus x prime. Now, this delta function will multiply psi of x and psi of the same x because it's the delta function of x minus x prime. So it will exactly cancel this term. So I'll get an expression which is actually simpler to look at, dx dx prime v of x minus x prime psi dagger psi psi x x prime x. That's the interaction written in second quantized form. Notice on the left daggers, on the right non-daggers. It's called normal ordered form. Useful for, very soon we see why. It's useful to have normal ordered forms. And this expression here is the interaction in terms of fields. Question is, if you take atoms with hardcore, very short range interaction, this potential might be very short range. It might be very close to like a delta function. And then one can simplify this expression and write just, if this is a delta function, just one integral instead of two integrals. Okay? And that's actually the model that we want to discuss. I'll give it a bit more justification. So if we have a very short range interaction, how do we deal with the short range interaction? Okay, let's say relative to density to the power 1 over dimension. So this is the distance between particles. Then V becomes just G over 2 integral ddx psi dagger, psi, psi, all evaluated at the same point. This is replacing long range to the short range. It's not necessary to do it. Just in the future, I want to discuss the Hamiltonian that is written in terms of a short range interaction. Somebody wants to think about longer range. It's no big deal to add it too. But a lot of the physics of interactions will be captured by this G, exactly like the Hubbard model captures a lot of the physics of interaction between electrons by a parameter U. Because the short range part is really the important part, especially when the density is low. So, what is the final Hamiltonian? Well, there's one more thing I need to do. The kinetic part here, essentially p squared over 2m, describes motion of neutral particles like helium, like rubidium atoms, which have no charge. It's very easy to add the electromagnetic field into the kinetic term according to the laws of classical mechanics. There's just one small change one has to do, is to take P and add a gauge potential A. So electromagnetism is simply including taking P and going P minus Q over C. Q is the charge of the bosons, not to mix up with the momentum Q. I don't want to put E or 2E because I don't want to restrict myself to a certain kind of charges, but P minus Q over C times A is what you need to do to take the Hamiltonian and make it coupled to an electromagnetic field A. So my Hamiltonian now becomes integral dx psi star open parenthesis, minus I h bar grad minus q over c a, all this squared divided by 2m. I could put 2m star if I want more generally. And this will become my kinetic term. minus mu times psi dagger x psi x is my chemical potential term that controls the density, and then I'll have plus g over 2 integral dx psi dagger x psi x psi dagger x psi psi. And this is a Hamiltonian to describe interacting bosons which are charged in electromagnetic field. How do they behave? What do they want to do? When the field is zero, when the field is not zero, everything that you want to know will come from diagonalizing this Hamiltonian. Of course, we don't know how to diagonalize a Hamiltonian with four operator term, and that's why I put it here. Okay, it's easy to diagonalize this part. It will essentially be A of Q will be the eigenmodes. Well, it's not completely easy when A is describes some kind of a non-trivial field, but it's still a single particle Hamiltonian that one can diagonalize easy. But this term here makes differences. If I look at just this part here and even not put an electromagnetic field, these are free bosons. And free bosons at zero temperature in 2 and 3 dimensions are known to give us what's called Bose condensation. Bose condensation is essentially in the same family as superconductivity in terms of what symmetry it breaks. But I don't review now what you've studied in undergraduate on Bose condensation, because I want to treat the interactions as well. The interactions are very important, because a Bose condensation, BEC, Bose-Einstein condensation, that was defined for free bosons, is a pathological limit that has no physical content in a real system because it's unstable. It has infinite compressibility. All the stability of the order parameter of the phenomenon of superfluidity comes actually from this interaction term. So it's not a perturbation, it's of essence. Okay, and this is a point that sometimes is missed in the way people explain superfluidity and so on. Okay, there's one observable that can be defined on a system with a gauge field. The moment you put in a vector potential into this Hamiltonian, you actually seem to spoil some symmetry that exists without the chemical, without the term here. Okay, that's gauge symmetry. So I just want to describe what the gauge field is. Can I write on this? I'm not sure. Okay. So what I want to describe now is the effect of the gauge field. Okay, I don't want it. It's too clever. Okay, so what is the effect of a gauge field? The effect of a gauge field is very important in understanding superfluidity and superconductivity. It messes with the kinetic energy, and therefore it introduces effects that change the ground state. One important observable that one defines is the operator called current. Current is a vector operator. It's actually three operators defined at a position x. And it's really given by taking the functional derivative of h with respect to the field A as a vector. So if I want to put indices here, if I put alpha here and the vector field alpha, what will I get when I take a functional derivative of this expression? So you notice that the gauge field doesn't appear here, doesn't appear here, only appears here. So it only depends on the kinetic energy, and it will give me, by taking a derivative with respect to A, it'll give me this to the power 1, factor of 2 will cancel this, and it'll give me essentially this operator acting on this variable. So I'll get Q divided by MC. The factor of 2 will give me integral, it will give actually psi of x, and then I'll have a minus IH grad minus Q over CA psi of x. So if you want, this is like P, the momentum, divided by mass, it's velocity, and I'm measuring it at position x. Another nicer way to do it is to anti-symmetrize the gradient, because you can act with the gradient on the right, and you can act on the left, and the difference is just a full derivative. So I can also anti-symmetrize this and write it as a Hermitian operator, Q divided by MC, grad psi dagger psi, minus, sorry, this is actually minus, and then there's a IH, MC, and then there's a factor of 2, and then there's a psi dagger of x, grad psi of x, and I shouldn't forget this term here, which is minus, no, it was a plus because I took a derivative to minus QC, so I get a plus, and then I have a Q squared divided by MC squared times A squared times psi of X squared, which is the density, sorry, psi dagger psi. Yes. Okay, so when I take the derivative, I could do it a bit more carefully because what I'm doing is taking a functional derivative inside an integral, right? So I can symmetrize this expression. This expression is a gradient acting only on the right. But I can write it also as a gradient acting also on the left. The difference is going to be a total derivative, so it vanishes. So by, right, that means that if I write it in a symmetrized form, so that essentially I'm applying this operator, half of it on the left minus half of it on the right, the gradient term, then when I take the derivative, I'll get these two terms here. Just a nicer form to write it, to give me, essentially that's the correct form to give me a Hermitian functional derivative. I want this to be Hermitian, and this is now written in a Hermitian form. Okay, so this is the current density operator written in second quantized form. You might recognize a similar operator from Schrödinger equation when you had the wave function here. But this is not the wave function, these are fields, okay? Don't confuse. These are fields, they just have happened to have exactly the same form as if in the Schrödinger equation you looked for the single particle current in a wave function psi of x. So that's one observable that you get from this Hamiltonian. And and that's a very important observable that we'll discuss once we manage to solve this Hamiltonian, find its ground state, and then we want to evaluate this quantity. Yes? Oh, not A squared, A. Of course, it has to be a vector. Now the energy has A squared, yeah, sorry. You're right. Okay, how do we deal with the Hamiltonian? How do we calculate its properties? We need a representation, okay? So think what we did in the spin problem. In the spin problem, we had operators, S plus, S minus, SZ. We didn't know how to diagonalize the Hamiltonian. It's very complicated on a finite system even. But we found a representation, which was spin coherent states, where you took the expectation value Hamiltonian and became simple, became essentially a function of the parameters of the coherent states, which you can minimize and find a good description of the ground state. We're going to do exactly the same thing, but we need now states which these kind of operators would look simple in. And those are the boson coherent states that you've been introduced to. I'll give you a short review of the boson coherent states, and then we'll use them, and immediately we'll start getting results for interacting bosons. Okay? The Bose coherent states are much more than just a tool. They actually give us the understanding of what's going on. That's I really tried my wrecked my brain many times to try to explain superfluidity without boson coherent states. No success. So boson coherent states are of essence, and we'll write them down, and I guess in the next lecture we'll actually work out the theory of superfluidity. So boson coherent states are very similar to spin coherent states. And you can make a path integral out of them. You can define, okay, a coherent state Z is e to the minus Z squared over 2 plus Z times A dagger times the vacuum. You can show that Z and Z prime are not orthogonal to each other. The overlap is Z star Z prime minus a half Z squared minus a half Z prime squared. You can write a resolution of identity dz over pi, d squared z. These are complex numbers. You have to integrate over the real part and the imaginary part. The imaginary, let's call it x, dy divided by pi, where z is x plus iy. So it's, if you write now d squared z over pi z ket z bra, you get the resolution of identity of the boson, this quantum, the harmonic oscillator states, or the boson occupation Fock states of a single site. And now you can construct multi-site. So z1 to zm is a coherent state, which is simply e to the sum over I runs from 1 to m, zi a dagger I minus a half zi squared. That's the normalization. This will obey all what we wrote before, except now with many indices. You can define a resolution of identity of the many-body Fock space in the grand canonical ensemble as dz1 to dzm d squared over pi to the m. And then you have z, and now I write them as vectors. So with this kind of resolution of identity, it's easy to write a path integral. A path integral for the partition function. Ah, I forgot one more thing. When you write an operator, A times Z is Z times Z. And A dagger acting on a bra is the bra with A star, with Z star. So when you have this kind of a rule, it's very easy to find expectation values of second quantized operators. For instance, if I have Z with some operator, sum over I, ci, 1, cn, n1, nm, where I write here a dagger 1 to the power n1, a dagger m to the power n m. And then I have a to the of m to the power n m prime. I'm making it the most complicated sum I can write. N1 prime. This is the most general second quantized operator with m different modes. Has these coefficients n1 to nm, n1 prime to nm prime. And I put it in a coherent state. What will happen? I'll just change all the a's to z's. So I'll get a sum over I, the same coefficient, z star from all the a daggers, 1 n1 to z star m to nm. And here I'll get just z's. Z1 to N1 prime, Zn M to N1, Nm prime. Very simple. But noticed that this way I wrote the second quantized operator was normal ordered. So in order to replace A's with Z's, I need to put all the daggers on the left, all the non-daggers on the right. Otherwise, if I had here a non-dagger squeezed in the middle, I'll need to commute it and I'll get ones, which will mess me up a little bit. So first I order them, then I find the expectation value. Okay. Now, a partition function is really an integral d, now I write it as a path integral, dz0, where this is my, actually, if I keep the vector sign, I don't need to write it as a script d, just this is my my trace, and then I have 1 minus e times h, 1 minus epsilon times h. I have it n epsilon times, and I'm putting it between the coherent state z0. And now I put resolution of identities in every single, between every single product, I put a resolution of identity. Each resolution of identity will be a coherent state characterized by n variables at a certain time tau. So exactly like with the spin path integral, I need to do two things. Evaluate the overlap of different times, close by times. That'll give me the Berry phase. And I'll have to evaluate the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, but that's easy. That's this kind of evaluation. So I'll just get a function, and that function will give me the path integral, will give me the action of the path integral. So it's exactly what we did with the spin, so I'm doing it fast. So for this, for the different time steps, the overlap is going to be written in a discrete form, and then I take the continuum approximation or put continuum notation. So if I have a z at time tau, and I'm calculating it z to tau time plus epsilon, what is the overlap? Well, we wrote it upstairs. It's z star tau, z tau plus epsilon, minus a half z of tau squared, minus z of tau plus epsilon squared times a half. If I take a product of a tau, of all the z tau, where tau runs from epsilon to n, actually, sorry, from 0 to n epsilon minus, to n epsilon, I'll just sum over all these terms. E to the sum over tau, z star tau, z tau plus epsilon, minus a half z tau, minus a half z tau plus epsilon. Now this a half is a bit too much because I have here a sum over tau. So every tau is counted twice. Once it's counted for tau, and then it's counted for tau minus epsilon as its plus epsilon term. So I just reshuffle the expression and it looks like sum over tau, z star tau, z tau plus, just a second, epsilon minus z of tau. So this is the form. Now remember what we did with the spin coherent states. We said if you have two close by in time configurations and my z's eventually are going to be smooth functions that contribute to the path integral, I can write this as a derivative, z dot, if I divide by epsilon, and then the sum over tau times epsilon becomes an integral. So this becomes e to the integral 0 to beta d tau z star tau, z star z dot tau. Okay? So if you look at this object is a complex number conjugate times the time derivative integrated over time. This actually is going to be purely imaginary. The reason it's going to be purely imaginary is because if I write this term as an amplitude and a phase, I'll see that the amplitude part is going to be a total derivative. And I know from the construction of the path integral that z of 0 is equal to z of beta. So this periodicity will make it fall. But so far, I leave it this form. It's just this is what we call the Berry phase. Exactly like the spin Berry phase, if I have here many degrees of freedom, then I will get just an index I on every one of them. So I'll have a sum over I, and this will be sum over I. For every single site, I'll have a Berry phase associated with that site. And that's it. That's going to be the product of all the overlaps. So the path integral is going to be the product of all the overlaps plus the Hamiltonian. And that's going to look like the compact form that I'll give you now. And the partition function of n bosons as a function of beta, electromagnetic gauge potential, whatever, is a path integral over z of tau e to the integral 0 to beta d tau, two terms, z star dot z dot, as vectors I write it here, minus, and here I'll have the Hamiltonian evaluated at the same time, because corrections of non-equal time here are higher order in epsilon, and that's all I need. One can say, is this recognizable in terms of, let's say, path integrals that you might have seen using P's and Q's, like the one we said about the harmonic oscillator? Well, yes, if I define Z as Q plus IP, where these are momentum and coordinate of harmonic oscillator, then it's easy to see that this Berry phase becomes PQ dot minus QP dot divided by 2. There's a square root of 2 here. So that becomes just this guy. And this becomes the Hamiltonian with P and Q that you get from classical mechanics. So the coherent state path integral is nothing more than the phase space path integral, where d squared z is the, remember, it's the imaginary part integral and the real part. So it's nothing but dp and dq. The sum over histories of momentum and position. Here, a Berry phase, which is part of the Lagrangian in phase space, pq dot minus qp dot divided by 2, or I can keep only one of them using a total time derivative. So this is an action you might have seen before. It's completely equivalent to the coherent state path integral. Okay? In the case that these z's are written as q and p, which are coming from some microscopic dynamics. When you talk about boson occupations, there's no real p and q in the problem. You really define it from the number representation of the spectrum. And this q and p that harmonic oscillators have in order to construct the energy eigenstates is a fictitious inner space that you never see. Okay, you only see the spectrum and the quantization of number. But in the path integral, as I said, these z's really represent these p's and q's if you insist on having more of a kind of a intuitive understanding what it does. So all we need to do now, which we'll do in the next lecture, is put in the Hamiltonian that we derived for interacting bosons in the coherent state path integral, find the ground state, find the lowest energy h, find the dynamics, what happens when we want to look at the classical equation of motion or equation of motion that it gives, and find what happens when you put an electromagnetic field A, and how does it change the ground state, gives you persistent currents and properties like that. So I think I taught you enough for one day, so I'll see you tomorrow.